Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. On today's program, the post-truth world, reviving the propaganda model of news for our digital age. We'll be joined for the hour by Dr. Rob Williams, longtime contributor to Project Censored. He has a new article addressing an update for the propaganda model for the 21st century. Please stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. This is a new article by Dr. Rob Williams, and Rob Williams should be a name that Project Censored listeners know. Rob has been a longtime contributor to the project and also works with us at the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. Rob Williams teaches media, communications, and global studies at the University of Vermont and is the founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education. He publishes Vermont Independent News Journal, and you can find his work online at projectcensored.org as well as several other websites. Rob Williams, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Great to be with you, Mickey.
Rob, this is fantastic to have you back. You know, just this past week or so, we replayed one of the Project Censored programs from last fall where you were toying around with the update of the propaganda model. And we had you on, and Abby Martin and Andy Lee Roth, our associate director, and we were talking about, you know, the changing face of media and censorship and media control in an era of post-truth and alternative facts and fake news. Right. And you and I got into that conversation and you said, hey, I'm going to expand on all these ideas. And we were lucky enough to twist your arm, so to speak, into producing this new article that you were already working on.
You are very persuasive, Mickey, and I was ripe for the opportunity. So I'm really excited about this new article that projectcensored.org is going to feature. And we'll do our best to get these new filters for the propaganda model of news out there for teachers and students and citizens and independent journalists to work with.
You said it, and it's a mouthful. That's the reason why we talked about putting this online, where we have far more viewers, listeners, people coming and reading. Certainly we have the annual book. But this kind of stuff is really hot, timely, and even though Andy Roth and I are working on the next censored book, that won't be out until the fall. And you know,
this can't wait, Mickey. It can't wait.
It cannot wait, because we started this conversation last fall, and here we are in February. So I think it's time to hit the ground running. The Post-Truth World is the title of your article. Let's remind listeners a little bit that this is riffing on the propaganda model. And Edward Herman, along with Noam Chomsky back in 1988, published a book called Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media. And in this book, riffing on the terminology from Edward Bernays, sort of the grandfather of public relations and propaganda in the U.S.,
right.
nephew of Sigmund Freud. Manufacturing consent back in the teens, 20s, 30s, that was basically the way that modern democracies, it was argued by Bernays and other elites, that that's how it ought to be run, that you can kind of control what people are thinking about and talking about by controlling the flow of information. And they believed that this was right, just, and proper. Of course, Ed Herman, the political economist from the University of Pennsylvania, Noam Chomsky, MIT, they put together this book and put together the propaganda model to talk about what's wrong with manufacturing consent from a democratic standpoint or perspective. And as you know, Chapter 7 of Censored 2018, which is Press Freedoms in a Post-Truth World, that's Ed Herman's last published piece, to my knowledge. He was in his early 90s, and again, the late, great Ed Herman passed away late last year, we're very sad to say. But he gave us one fantastic chapter in an update, and I thought it was amazing how much he was foreshadowing so many of the things that you ended up writing about. So Chomsky and Herman updated their study in 2002, 2008, and then again here, Herman, the Project Censored version, the propaganda model at 30 in our last book, and then you go and take it even a step above that. So we're fortunate to have you for the hour today, Rob, and we have a lot to talk about. So why don't you launch into this and tell us a little bit, just remind listeners what exactly was the original propaganda model, and then let's kind of bring it up to the present and talk about some ways in which we see propaganda both here going on in the present, and that'll give us an opportunity to apply the new filters that you managed to discuss.
Yeah, that sounds great. I like it. And that was a great setting, Mick. The first thing to say is that everything we're going to talk about in the next little bit is available as a two-page handout for free at vermontindependent.org, and I think Project Censored will carry this as well. It's the propaganda model of news for the digital age, boiled down to two really powerful pages of teaching and learning content. So we hope that everyone listening will check that out at projectcenter.org, vermontindependent.org. And to answer your question, the propaganda model of news was Chomsky and Herman's guided market system analysis, they called it, of six different filters through which they argued all raw information had to pass through in the U.S. so-called news and information culture before it could see the light of day. And they focused on the New York Times, which a lot of people to this day are convinced is the objective daily newspaper of record in the United States. But, of course, their analysis of the New York Times in the mid-1980s, particularly with regard to foreign coverage of U.S. activities abroad, leaves us thinking that perhaps the New York Times is a little bit more subjective and a little bit more complicated than that. So what they did in the propaganda model of news, Chomsky and Herman, is they laid out six different filters through which raw information had to pass to be published as official news in the New York Times and other outlets. And those six filters were, in order, number one, ownership, number two, advertising, number three, news makers. We're going to add a fourth filter, news shapers. Number five, what they called negative criticism or flack. And number six, ideology, which in the 1980s, the ideology of which they spoke, of course, was anti-communism, using the Cold War as a frame to determine which stories were newsworthy in the New York Times and which were not, and using that ideology filter as well as a framing device for determining how to tell particular stories, the particular so-called news stories that they did. So those were the six filters that Chomsky and Herman argued you could understand why the U.S. news system produced the so-called news and information that it did, if you understood how those six filters worked to allow certain kinds of news stories told in certain kinds of ways through the filters into published news, and how they blocked or censored or suppressed or ignored or downplayed other vital news stories told in different sorts of frames from seeing the light of day and public conversation. So that's, in a nutshell, how the propaganda model of news worked in their conceptual model. Six filters together creating a guided market system for the production of news and information by the New York Times and, by extension, the U.S. news industry. And it is an industry, the news industry as a whole.
Yeah, it's private and for-profit. And just so listeners maybe don't get confused, the original propaganda model, as you said, had five filters, but you broke up the third sourcing in a way that really is sort of like news makers and shapers, is so maybe a more specific kind of terminology.
Yes, and we actually borrowed that idea from the Media Education Foundation, another big partner and collaborator with Project Censored and ACME and Vermont Independent. They did a video version of the propaganda model of news with Noam Chomsky and Edward Herman in the early 1990s, and they actually nuanced out the third filter, newsmakers, into two. One was newsmakers, individuals by their kind of high-profile status who were deemed worthy of news, the President of the United States, the First Lady, the Supreme Court, etc. And then what they called news shapers, as you mentioned, which were organizations like think tanks, foundations, PR firms that were in the business literally of shaping, massaging, shaping the news through all kinds of often hidden production means.
Indeed. And you're referring to Media Education Foundation, mediaed.org. That's Sut Jolly and the team he has. They make fantastic documentaries about media, including the one you have. And of course, we'll be sure to link all of the things that we're referring to on our social media. So when this goes up in social media, which, by the way, we'll be talking about later as another part of the landscape for the propaganda model, right?
Yes, we will.
We'll definitely link to these, though, so that listeners can go and click on and certainly see the older film that Sut did and so forth. But so now that we have this idea, and it's important also to point out that Edward Herman was very clear, and he also reiterated this in the last article he did in Censor 2018 for the propaganda model at 30. It was interesting because he tackled some of the critics in the chapter. And what he pointed out was, he said, a lot of the people that were criticizing the model were criticizing straw person. They were criticizing things that Chomsky and Herman never said or purported. And they were ignoring the mountains of evidence that they laid out in their 1988 book. And so this is, of course, what led to a couple of different updates and so on. And Herman reiterates this in his last piece by saying, we never said that this explained everything. But as a model for a theoretical construct for understanding propaganda, censorship, and what shapes news in a for-profit system, he argued that it has stood the test of time. And I agree with him, and I believe you do as well, and I know that that's part of your conclusion in your article that listeners can see at projectcensored.org. But let's bring us up to the present here momentarily, because there's definitely a lot of things going on right now. In fact, it's breakneck speed. There's studies and articles going on about fake news and you know, bots and filters and all kind of things that we're going to get into here in a bit. But there's also something else in the news, and that's a movie about the news. That's The Post. And you have a wonderful pithy, that's with a T-H, F-C-C, pithy and witty title, The Post-Truth World. And you start out with a film review of what's going on in Steven Spielberg's film, The Post. And Kevin Gostola, the independent journalist, was on the show not long ago talking about The Post. Tell us a little bit about your reaction to that film as a way of launching into the update of the model itself.
So Steven Spielberg delivered a really brilliant feel-good fictional film about the Washington Post's 1971 publishing of Daniel Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers. And, you know, true to Spielberg's style, it's a beautifully shot movie. It is a feel-good film, and it's also a piece of propaganda. And it was really sort of striking to watch Meryl Streep, who plays the Post's proto-feminist publisher, Katharine Graham, playing opposite Tom Hanks, who is the likably macho Post editor Ben Bradley, and how the two of them work with their news team against all odds, of course, which is the Hollywood trope, to deliver this very important story about the U.S. government's lies and deceptions around the U.S. invasion of Vietnam to the public and throwing that whole conversation into the public arena. It's a piece of propaganda because, of course, a lot of what appears in Hollywood movies based on so-called, you know, real-life events are fictionalized and made up and imagined and cribbed, et cetera. But the other really interesting thing about the film is that it completely ignores the role that the commercial news media in the United States played in pumping up support for the U.S. invasion of Vietnam and the Vietnam War as a whole for years and years and years, before Katharine Graham and Ben Bradley saw the light and decided to deliver Ellsberg's Pentagon Papers to the world. Namely and specifically, and I know listeners of Project Censored will appreciate this, the relationship that the Central Intelligence Agency, the so-called deep state player here, cultivated with U.S. news editors, publishers, behind the scenes and in secret to promote the pro-U.S. invasion position in Vietnam, without making any of that clear to U.S. citizens, to readers. And this went on for years and years and years. Behind the scenes, the CIA conspiring with U.S. news bigwigs to promote the U.S. invasion.
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, Brian Covert has a fantastic piece in Censored 2017 on the Mighty Wurlitzer, right? Played by the Mighty Wurlitzer. And in fact, he cites, just because we're talking about The Post, and I'm going to get back to your critique of The Post here momentarily, but Katharine Graham, let's recall, the same year that Chomsky and Herman published Manufacturing Consent, Katharine Graham had a transcript of a speech that she delivered at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, called Secrecy and the Press. This is the same Graham that is, I believe, portrayed quite heroically in Spielberg's estimation. And Graham here, actually, she's chief executive officer of the Washington Post at the time. She said, quote, "It's an inescapable irony of democratic government that official secrecy is necessary to preserve liberty. We live in a dirty and dangerous world. There are some things the general public does not need to know and shouldn't. The government must have a classification system and should discipline employees who violate security regulations." Fascinating that Daniel Ellsberg doesn't play a major role in Spielberg narrative.
Yeah, he's played by Matthew Rhys-Meyer, and it's really Bob Odenkirk, actually, who really kind of steals the show as Post reporter Ben Bagdikian, who goes on, of course, to write one of the most important media critiques of our time, which is the media monopoly. But, you know, back to Catherine Graham's point, and I love that you bring this in here, Mickey, because, you know, Graham's wording is really curious. It's like, this isn't about the suppression of information. I mean, it is about that, but it's also about the active promotion of disinformation by U.S. news journals at the behest of the deep state.
Rob Williams, hold on to that thought for 1 minute, misinformation and disinformation. I just need to remind our listeners that I'm your host, Mickey Huff. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. Our guest today for the hour is media scholar and historian, as well as activist, Dr. Rob Williams. And we'll be back to continue our conversation about an update of the propaganda model for the 21st century. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On the program today, we're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He teaches media communications and global studies at the University of Vermont. He's also the founding president of the Action Coalition for Media Education, publishes Vermont Independent News Journal. Rob Williams is a longtime contributor and partner with Project Censored and ACME, as well as co-founder of the Global Critical Media Literacy Project. You can learn more about that at gcml.org. And Rob, I believe ACME is smartmediaeducation.net, yes?
That's correct. ACME, smartmediaeducation.net.
Right. Certainly, definitely an organization that people should be aware of and check out. But Rob, let's continue our conversation here on the propaganda model. And we were reviewing, I'm sorry, you were reviewing and sharing your thoughts with us about the Post. And I was chiming in and interrupting and making asides and detours as we professorial types are wont to do. But before the break, you brought up this very important piece about Catherine Graham, and you were talking about disinformation. And I just wanted to simply have a very quick differentiation for the listeners to make sure that it's very clear. Misinformation is mistaken information that's transmitted to the public. Disinformation is deliberate information that is fed that is erroneous or deceptive, correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
Okay, so I just wanted to make that point. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think of misinformation usually as kind of a one-off, too. You know, it's like, oh, yeah, we made a mistake. We misinformed you. Here's what actually happened. But disinformation typically is part of a larger strategy of propaganda and deceit. I love that quotation that you give us from Catherine Graham, because clearly here she is in front of the CIA justifying the use of systematic disinformation campaigns by the U.S. press at the behest of the CIA and the deep state because ordinary citizens are too dumb to grapple with the complex, dirty realities of the day, which is sort of insulting at best.
Well, kind of channeling some H.L. Mencken there from the period of Lippmann and Bernays back in the 20s. And we certainly heard Chomsky and Herman, they make this kind of quipper saying like, well, these folks think the people or the public are too stupid and ignorant and they need to try to help them think. And that's where these disinformation campaigns come into play. And certainly the Post. I mean, the ironies are writ large, I suppose, if you look between the Times and the Post that herald themselves and herald their own greatness about breaking Watergate and these kind of things, which they didn't do, by the way. And that's actually the genesis of Project Censored. Right. Is Carl Jensen going back and seeing that there were other media covering this prior to Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward?
Exactly.
But at least to Bernstein's credit, he wrote a great piece in Rolling Stone on CIA media in 1977, looking at the history of purposeful disinformation. And then there's Graham 11 years later at Langley, basically saying this is what we need to do. So anyway, I digress. But let's get on to your conclusion about what you think is going on with the film, The Post. And then let's kind of talk a little bit more about, well, what exactly is news and what is fake news? And let's start unpacking some of that stuff. But what are your concluding thoughts about The Post?
Well, you know, I sort of ended by kind of bringing up the history of the Post to the present. So the Graham family, after working with the deep state and the CIA for decades to engage in disinformation campaigns while celebrating their breaking stories in the form of the Pentagon Papers and, of course, the Watergate scandal, where, by the way, Steven Spielberg ends the Post. He ends the Post with the Watergate break-in, and it was all Nixon's fault, you know. But the Graham family sold the Washington Post in 2013, 5 years ago, for $250 million to Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, who is now the world's richest man worth $100 billion. And so we now have a newspaper out of Washington, D.C., owned by a gentleman who sits on Pentagon boards, a gentleman who enjoys a $600 million cloud computing contract with the Central Intelligence Agency, and who runs a monopoly retail corporation that is hoovering, you know, one out of every two U.S. retail dollars out of our national retail economy.
And more recently, and rumor, Whole Foods.
Yeah, having bought Whole Foods. And rumor has it, and I've been trying to sort of confirm this publicly, but the Washington Post, under Bezos's orders, apparently now has guidelines, and I use the word guidelines loosely, in place that dictate that no Washington Post reporter can write or publish anything that is critical of, wait for it, Amazon or any of its advertising partners, which is to say just about everybody.
You remember that the Post was, when there were some people talking about the extraordinary wealth of Bezos and others, the Washington Post bent over backwards and did these crazy, you know, mental gymnastics to talk about how he's not really that rich and so on. I mean, it was absolutely absurd degree of propaganda. But anyway, go ahead.
It's really astonishing. Yeah. So that's where we are today. We have the country's probably most powerful D.C.-based daily newspaper in the hands of the richest man in the world, who is probably the most predatory corporate capitalist we've seen in quite some time. And again, with connections to the Pentagon and the CIA. So a better illustration of a kind of fatal ending of the Post you probably could not ask for.
So let's pick up from there. We obviously realize that Hollywood has long worked with Washington, D.C. to make these kinds of films, and they certainly are trying to reinforce. In fact, what is the new slogan at the Washington Post?
Democracy dies in darkness.
Indeed. Indeed. And Jeff Bezos is there to turn out the lights.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, again, this is a news business. And this is what Chomsky and Herman were hitting at. And you mentioned Bagdikian earlier. In the very early 1980s, about 6 years before Manufacturing Consent was published, he wrote The Media Monopoly. And he was decrying the consolidation of media ownership, canary in coal mine fashion, that there were only 50 news corporations. And here we're down to five or six, right?
Correct.
So let's talk about this then. So in the 21st century, what is news? Well, you have a simple taxonomy that you go into. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you were defining this in your article?
I define real news with six sort of fairly straightforward elements. And I know you've done so many great stories on fake news, and I think you and I both agree, and probably many of your listeners do too, fake news is a weaponized phrase for an old phenomenon, which is propaganda, you know, the one-sided information distribution. Real news, on the other hand, I think has six criteria. Number one, real news is recent. Number two, real news is relevant. Number three, and here's where it gets more interesting, real news is reliable, which is to say it's accurately and transparently sourced. Number four, real news is framed historically, so it has historical context. Number five, real news is what I like to say hegemonically hip, which is to say it exposes or makes transparent power relations in the story. And number six, real news is multi-perspectival, or it's harmonious. It gives you a story from multiple points of view, not just kind of the he said, she said, or the either-or dualistic frame that we're so used to, but really looks at different points of view from different players connected and invested in a story of record. So those six characteristics, in our mind, make up so-called real news. And when you define real news that way, you realize that it can be hard to find out there.
Indeed, it is, actually. And I mean, I again want to remind readers, we're speaking with Dr. Rob Williams. I'm Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. Rob Williams has a new article on the Project Censored site called The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. And Rob, you just talked about so-called real news. But it's also interesting that you do spend a little bit of time in the article talking about a taxonomy of fake news, infotainment, junk food news that we've talked about at the Project for years, news abuse, which is basically a form of propaganda, deep state disinformation, clickbait, right? So you do go in and differentiate this, right? And then you kind of riff on what I'm now referring more to our epistemological crisis, so to speak.
Yes.
Project Censored used to talk about a truth emergency, but this is an epistemological crisis in which we find ourselves with this real versus fake news conundrum in social media.
That's correct. And I'm fond, as I know you are, Mickey, of quoting the great progressive journalist George Celtics, who said very famously, journalism's job is not impartial, quote unquote, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is not impartial, balanced reporting. Journalism's job is to tell the people what is really going on. And I think that's what's missing in our 21st century news culture today. The truth emergency is very real. This epistemological crisis of which you speak is very real. And most importantly, and solutions-oriented, the propaganda model of news is a very powerful antidote to that truth emergency, that state of epistemological crisis, because it offers us, Chomsky and Herman, with some updates, they offer us a really powerful conceptual tool, easy to understand, about how so-called news is produced and how we might best understand what passes for news these days.
Well, indeed. And, you know, as of late, there have been so many people writing more and more about this, I think, in important ways. I know Caitlin Johnson has a recent article. There's actually another study going on that talks about fake news as a right-wing thing, and I would certainly take issue with that. I think that the problem of fake news, as you've helped outline some of those issues in your article, those are long-standing and old in terms of propaganda and disinformation. But let's focus a little bit more of our attention on the antidote to some of this stuff, and you and I are both neck-deep in this, and that's, of course, critical media literacy education is the antidote to so-called fake news and propaganda. And so you spend time in the article, of course, talking about what are some new tools? What are some new ways that we can think about what's happening in our news media landscape? So maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the solutions. I know we're going to end up coming back into some of these other conversations, but you know, perhaps you want to talk a little bit about what some of these updates have been.
Let me lay out the filters that I suggest we add to the propaganda model of news to bring it up into the digital age in the 21st century. And to your point about solutions, critical media literacy education is crucial. And I think the propaganda model of news offers us some very powerful critical media literacy education tools. Each filter of the 11, really, filters in the model now that we're proposing, each of those 11 filters is in itself a critical media literacy education tool for understanding what's going on out there. And I wanted to say one other thing about the propaganda model. It's a very powerful conceptual tool. But the other thing that Edward Herman pointed out in the Project Censored 2018 essay that he wrote right before he died is that even communications scholars who study media and communications as their profession have dramatically underutilized, even ignored, the propaganda model of news in scholarly journals. I think they cite one study in which they look at 10 years of communications journals, and I think the propaganda model is cited 2.5% of the time in these articles, which to me was sort of astonishing.
I mean, it's interesting you brought that up, because in the introduction to the Censored 2012 book, I actually pointed that out, specifically looking at Daniel Hallin and Michael Judson. And I specifically pointed out how there was just a paucity of referencing and sourcing of this very crucial, important part of critical media literacy education, communication studies theory. It's just like disappeared down the memory hole, right? And I think it's very important that you point that out. And perhaps, Rob Williams, you might want to give us your thoughts about that. Why is it, do you think, that Chomsky and Herman's tool and now these updates of it, why do you think that this is being eschewed by establishment academics?
I honestly don't know, Mickey. And I'm going to be attending a bunch of conferences this next year, and I plan to ask that question because, to me, it's a no-brainer. I mean, it's a powerful, easy-to-access conceptual framework that I've been using with my students. They get it. They love it. They say, this makes a lot of sense when you kind of lay it out this way. why we get the so-called news and information that we get. It resonates with them. So to me, that just tells me that we should be using it much more than we seem to have been in the past couple of decades.
Well, Rob Williams, we're going to take another quick break here. But when we come back, we want to get into your updates, your additions to the filters of the propaganda model. I'm Mickey Huff, the host of the Project Censored Show. Today, we are rejoined by our good friend, Dr. Rob Williams. And after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation on an update to the propaganda model for the 21st century. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff, your host. Today we're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He is a professor and media scholar at the University of Vermont. He is one of the founding presidents of ACME, the Action Coalition for Media Education. Rob is a longtime contributor to Project Censored, and you can read about a very recent piece that he has published with us. It is the topic of our conversation today. The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. And of course, Rob Williams, this is also kind of a tribute to the late, great Edward Herman, who sadly passed away late in 2017. Certainly, Edward Herman was a giant in the field, along with Noam Chomsky and many others. There's a very interesting quote. You and I wanted to go through and now start updating the new filters for the digital age. And right. I just stumbled in, however, to this passage that you quoted from the last piece that Herman published, The Propaganda Model at 30. He said that the propaganda model is as strong and applicable as it was 30 years ago. The structural conditions have, if anything, given it more salience with greater media concentration, but still more competition for advertising revenue, enhanced power and reach of advertisers, and little if any diminution in the effects of the other three filters. What is more, the performance of the mainstream media, the corporate mainstream media, is in treating the run-up to the Iraq War, the conflict with Iran, and Russia's alleged election meddling aggression in Ukraine and Crimea, offers case studies of biases as dramatic as those offered in the 1988 edition of Manufacturing Consent. And Edward Herman concludes, the propaganda model lives on. And indeed, Rob Williams, you say yes, with three caveats, five more filters to refine the right. propaganda model of news. And that's where we're going right now. So why don't you launch us into this? Tell us, what are these additions? And again, I know I spoke with Edward Herman on the phone last summer, and this was one of the things that we discussed. We literally discussed the digital age. We had a deadline to meet. And Herman bemoaned, actually, to me. He said, I just wish I had more time. I mean, little did we know how prescient that was and how bigger of a statement that was on his behalf. But he really was thinking about along the same lines as where you're taking this. And I wanted listeners to know that he and I had that conversation.
Oh, that's great.
Which is, again, what so piqued my interest when I saw you were doing this last fall, and I'm just excited that you really followed through with this, Rob Williams. So take us there.
It really is a tribute to to Ed Herman, and he is such a legend and a giant, and he has shaped so much of my thinking about media and so much I know of yours and many of our colleagues who we work with quite closely around the world on this. So I did intend this article at projectcensored.org to be a tribute. And I also wanted to, in the tradition of scholarly thinking and research and the work that we do collaboratively, to kind of push us a little bit on it. And I do think that in the last piece he wrote in Project Censored, he was a little too quick to equate the age of analog with the age of digital. And so these filters that we've laid out here in this two-page handout, in this article, are really designed to build on the filtered model that Chomsky and Herman give us and bring us into the digital age. So the first filter of the digital age is what we call deep state disinformation. The term deep state is one that's now cracking into the cultural mainstream, and you know, books are being written by whistleblowers and people coming out of the deep state about how the deep state works. And quite simply, the deep state refers to unelected organizations that work within federal channels of power to shape events and policy. The CIA, the Pentagon, the FBI, the DEA are four that come to mind. And as we already talked about, we don't need to belabor it, but as we talked about, the Central Intelligence Agency was very actively collaborating with U.S. news publishers, editors, and high-profile national newspapers and magazines for decades to promote U.S. policies at home and abroad.
I just wanted to say very quickly, because the word deep state is being thrown around an awful lot just in the past year. And of course, we know Mike Lofgren, a former staffer in Congress, has written a book and a few others. I just want to do a quick hat tip here to people like Peter Dale Scott, David Talbot. You know, these are people that have done serious, long-term, historical, scholarly work in the deep state. So it does pain me some to see the term thrown around sloppily. And you are not, of course. That's my point. You are using the term in deep historiographic context. And look, we can go right all the way back to C. Wright Mills, Eisenhower, military-industrial complex. This is a real
power
thing.
Power elite, sure, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is not deep state headquarters has an address at Pennsylvania Avenue. This is a theoretical construct in many ways like the propaganda model. So I just wanted to throw that out there because there are some folks in the blogosphere and in the press that like to demean the deep state term as some kind of wacky conspiracy idea, when in fact Peter Dale Scott says that it is not. It's a real thing, and you can point to it even though it's nebulous. But I think it's very important that you're calling out that this is a demonstrable engine that does drive a public narrative.
Yeah, I really think it is. And it's interesting rereading Manufacturing Consent, because Ed Herman and Noam Chomsky understood deep in their bones how the deep state massaged news and information. They didn't use that term, but they use lots of other terms similar to it to describe what's going on. So we're kind of calling it out here, and we urge anybody who's interested in this new propaganda model 2.0 for the digital age to really look closely at the scholarly work done, as you say, around the deep state. The next filter we talk about, and this is a word we hear quite a bit now, is the filter known as the algorithm or algorithms. Algorithms, very simply, are computer code programs that are designed to shape our experience on digital media platforms. And algorithms can be tweaked and edited and changed, often without us knowing, to shape the kinds of news and information we receive or don't receive. And most famously and most recently, we talk about this in the article that at projectcensored.org. Last April, Google announced that in the name of fighting so-called fake news, they were going to tweak their algorithm to divert traffic away from so-called inappropriate or somehow controversial news sites like Truthdig, Truthout, Alternet, typically progressive, independent, or sites that are fairly critical of the status quo. And that was a real kind of wake-up call, I think, for a lot of people within the news and information world, to the power of the algorithm to do in secret what used to take a lot longer and a lot more time and energy to do in the face-to-face world. You probably have some thoughts to add there, Mick.
We had some business in the Censored 2018 book about the problem of algorithms and how might that shape news and build confirmation bias, the degree to which people really are kind of only seeking out to confirm that which they already believe or suspect to be true. That's one of the ways in which so-called fake news allegedly was impacting the population. Again, I think that rising to the occasion of the effect of algorithms, to me, goes right back to the basic issues of critical thinking education and critical media literacy. Is the best antidote or protection toward these things is being aware of your confirmation bias and seeking out information that doesn't only confirm it, but factually you can point and say, well, these things are happening. These are empirical facts. square peg, round hole. Maybe this doesn't fit into my belief system, but that doesn't mean it isn't a fact. The big problem with algorithms, right, is that these things are working against us literally in a way that they're allegedly working for us to continue to please us. Aldous Huxley comes to mind. But we see people at Facebook and others admitting that this is a problem, admitting that this is not necessarily a great idea. But they're also now deliberately using algorithms to turn down or tune out or spike or suppress sources that are critical of the establishment that they are increasingly making synonymous with fake news.
That's right. So think of the algorithm filter as something that is done to us as digital news consumers, often in secret, by the coders who work for these very powerful digital corporations, Google, Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, etc. And it's important to be aware of them and kind of track information in real time about how algorithms are changed, often without us knowing, and how that might impact our news choices.
By the way, you call that algorithmic censorship.
Yes.
You use the phrase algorithmic censorship. And by the way, all the companies you just mentioned are part of the octopus.
Yeah.
That's this other conversation we're not having, the new breaking up of all these oligopolies of media and information.
Yeah, we got to break up the lords of the cloud. So there's algorithmic censorship. There's deep state disinformation. The third filter we identify is one coined by MoveOn.org and Upworthy.org co-founder Eli Pariser. It's a term your listeners probably know, and that is the term filter bubble. The filter bubble is something that we do to ourselves through repeated news search to the same sites, the same sources over time. The filter bubble works to kind of, as you said just a moment ago, corroborate our choices and exclude other options, other points of view, other ways of thinking or feeling about things that don't immediately confirm to our own biases. So being aware of one's filter bubble and pushing oneself outside of one's kind of comfort zone with regard to news is a really important critical media literacy education action that all of us can take, regardless of our politics, to really begin to try and see things from different points of view. And that's ultimately the essence of healthy democracy and debate, is being able to engage with people and organizations who think or feel differently than we do.
Well, Rob Williams, you just said another mouthful here. Not only do we have these bubbles in our virtual reality and in our online presence and in the social media world, we actually kind of have them in the physical world, right?
We do.
Geographically.
Yeah.
Was just talking to our producer here, Dennis, who was just traveling about that, and he was in Texas and was just talking about, you know, just the very immediate kind of stereotypical differences in communications and, oh, you're from California, or, you know, these kinds of things. And basically, this is what you're getting at online with the filter bubble.
That's right. And it's a really insidious one, because confirmation bias, you know, is a very real phenomenon. And we all want to have our ways of thinking and feeling about the world confirmed for us. It makes us feel more secure in an insecure world. And yet, it works against us in terms of really understanding multiple points of view and different perspectives on things. So super important to flag that as a term delivered to us, phenomenon delivered to us by the digital age.
I would add two other terms relatively synonymous with confirmation bias, and that these are, you've seen certainly in sociological circles, but definitely used as ways of understanding electoral behavior and general beliefs of the public that fuel electoral behavior. And those terms, of course, you're familiar with are motivated reasoning and inferred justification, right? Going back and looking at something, there must be a reason that this happened. And if the establishment narrative was incorrect and mistakes were made with WMDs, there must be a reason we invaded Iraq. That must be because Hussein was behind 9/11. Because it was ritually conflated in the Bush administration without actually being stated outright that Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein were somehow two nefarious characters that lived together and partied it up to, you know, see the demise of the United States, the great white devil, even though they were in fact enemies and Hussein kept those the Al-Qaeda cells out of Iraq until we invaded. But that's one of the classic examples of inferred justification, motivated reasoning. It's a real problem, because it was 70-odd percent of the public that ended up believing these falsehoods that ended up leading to the support for that catastrophic invasion, leaving 1.5 million people dead and 6 million refugees. That's still going on. So confirmation bias, inferred justification, motivated reasoning, filter bubbles, algorithmic censorship, these lead the public. They manufacture consensus, right? These are the dots we're trying to connect as we go through here, going back to Bernays through Chomsky, Herman, and now here through you, Rob, in your latest piece, The Post-Truth World, right? And we're reviving the propaganda model of news for our digital age. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. This is the Project Censored Show. So, Rob Williams, let's go and look and continue down the list. You have, after filter bubbles and after you talk about algorithms, you have another filter.
This one is really super insidious, and I'm still sort of astonished by it. It's called behavioral micro-targeting. And this is a term, behavioral micro-targeting, that has been coined by a UK-based consulting company called Cambridge Analytica. Project Censored readers are familiar probably with Robert Mercer, the reclusive mathematician, algorithmist, and philanthropist who has funded a number of right-wing organizations. But Cambridge Analytica boasts an astonishing 5,000 pieces of individual data on each of 220 million U.S. voters. And they claim that they can reach into the world of digital media networks, Facebook, Twitter, for example, and behaviorally micro-target key niche groups of people in various swing states, for example, to sway a presidential election through changing these micro groups' behavior based on the data they have collected about them. And they have claimed also, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, that the Trump campaign in 2016 and the weeks before the election results hired Cambridge Analytica to engage in this sort of behavioral micro-targeting to massage key groups of U.S. voters in key demographic areas to help swing the outcome. But the larger phenomenon going on here is this. If Cambridge Analytica does possess all of this big data on us and can crunch it and reach into the internet, social media platforms, digital media platforms, and without us really realizing what's going on, change, shape our behavior, that clearly is a universal phenomenon that shapes our understanding of news and information that deserves to be its own filter. So that's why we lay this out as an important filter here in the new propaganda model of News 2.0.
Indeed. And Rob Williams, you have a story that you were a faculty evaluator for with your student. Is it Ketchen McElwain?
Ketchen McElwain, great student.
That's story number 4 in Censored 2018, voter suppression in the 2016 presidential election. And that's partly where you do talk a little about all of that happening, correct?
Yes. It's a really important story. And it's just beginning to sort of break in the national media. There's been a little bit of coverage in it in the New York Times, the New Yorker. But I think the powers that be are just getting their heads around what this actually means for voting integrity, democratic discourse. We can blame the Russians for hacking the 2016 election all we want. But this, to me, is the real story of the election of 2016, behavioral micro-targeting.
And there were some people decrying, like, oh, so there were some Facebook ads. Look, how many billions of dollars are being spent by the two major parties,
well,
the military-industrial complex, the security complex? How many billions of dollars of profits were the media making when Les Moonves, CEO of CBS, was just crowing about how Donald Trump was bad for America but great for CBS and shareholders?
Great for ratings.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more problems right here at home that don't involve Vladimir Putin. We've got enough things to worry about here, and you're certainly giving us a lot to think about, particularly around the issue of behavioral micro-targeting. You're listening to the Project Censored Show. Our guest today is media scholar and historian, as well as activist, Dr. Rob Williams. And we'll be back to continue our conversation. Please stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're joined by Dr. Rob Williams. He teaches media communications and global studies at the University of Vermont. So you've got two other filters here that we want to address.
Yeah, so this, just to finish up. So filter number 10 is what we call sock puppets, which is a fun term for really what are fake social media accounts driven often by bots, robots, on social media spaces. And these sock puppets, these fake, often anonymous social media accounts, can be used to either support or attack particular political candidates or points of view or campaign positions. You know, we're living in sort of real time here. The New York Times actually just did two Sundays ago, a really actually brilliant for the New York Times, three-page feature story in the Sunday Times about what they're calling now the follower factory, how celebrities, politicians can manufacture fake followers by hiring third-party corporations who specialize in the creation of sock puppets. And they're calling this phenomenon the hashtag follower factory, the literal manufacturing, in many cases, of millions of sock puppets, fake social media accounts that are unleashed into our digital spaces to support or attack particular campaigns or candidates or what have you. So the term sock puppet, or bot is another word that people are using, is its own filter, because to recognize the power of fake social media accounts by the thousands, the millions, which are kind of at play now in our news and information culture, is a really important filter to be aware of. I know that the Democrats and the Republicans before the election were guilty of using sock puppets for various information warfare and news generation purposes.
And Rob Williams, it's also the case at Project Censored, we've covered several stories going back almost a decade that look at fake social media accounts. In fact, one story we did a number of years ago was on people within the U.S. military creating 10 to 20 accounts that they would specifically manage, and that their goal was to follow people. Rob Williams, that means that, you know, if you and I are on Facebook, it's the picture of some allegedly alluring or enticing person we don't know suddenly friending us from nowhere. And we see
Correct.
That they're also friends with three other people that we know, and we look on their page and there's nothing there, and we immediately dismiss them and move them out of our way. Because
right.
The first thing that comes to mind is like, this is a fake account. This is espionage in a certain way. But it's also through social media, we're giving access to the deep
That's
state.
Right.
We're just giving it away.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, a single sock puppet account isn't really a problem. But when you can replicate anonymous fake social media accounts by the hundreds or thousands or even millions, and then deploy these through bots in targeted news information ways, that's when it becomes a problem. So that's our 10th filter. And then the final filter is one that kind of is an umbrella filter, I think. And that is what Chomsky and Herman in 1988 called the filter of ideology. And you mentioned it at the very beginning of the show, but anti-communism was the defining ideology of the late Cold War period, right, in the 1980s. It was an existential threat to the so-called Western capitalist democratic way of life, to U.S. civilization as a whole. And anti-communism as an ideology has morphed, I think, into what we might call maybe two sides of the same coin, terrorism on kind of the evil face, and then neoliberalism as a kind of a rabid form of corporate capitalism on the flip side, as being, you know, all that is good and right in the world. So that filter of ideology, terrorism slash neoliberalism, has replaced the anti-communism slash capitalism binary as a powerful ideological filter. And I know your listeners know this, but it was really Thatcher and Reagan who took neoliberalism out of the pages of Ayn Rand and moved it into policy in the 1980s. And then it was, of course, picked up by the globalists, the Clintons, the Obamas in the U.S.
Well, the Bushes, elsewhere. The Trumps, so, all of them.
The Bushes, the Trumps, of course. Yeah. And it's a bipartisan phenomenon.
Strange that while anti-communism has sort of waned, even though we clearly have anti-socialist tendencies,
right.
While anti-communism has waned, anti-Russia has not.
Russia is the anti-Russian sentiment. The new McCarthyism is back, even though the Soviet Union collapsed.
Rob Williams, at the end of your piece, you have a great quote from Herman, one of his monthly review piece from 2017 on fake news in Russia. He asks, qui bono, right? The mainstream, the corporate mainstream news media never ask qui bono. right? Who benefits? Right.
Who benefits?
Follow the money. Right. And in the news industry, right, this is something that's key. And in fact, the core, really, of the 21st century digital age propaganda model of news really is a great extension of the work that they did back in the 1980s.
Yeah, we hope so. And it's really been a collaborative effort. And our hope is that Project Censored and Vermont Independent and the Action Coalition for Media Education and the Media Education Foundation and others will really work together to revive the Chomsky-Herman model, bring it up to speed for the digital age, and really use it as a powerful antidote to fake news, to propaganda, to disinformation, and really use it as a way to help all of us understand why we get the news we get, quote-unquote news we get so much of the time, and how we can do better. And many of us, I think, are working hard to do better, each in our own way, in terms of delivering news that we can really use rather than news abuse.
Indeed, Rob Williams, professor, activist, author. You can see his latest work at projectcensored.org, The Post-Truth World, Reviving the Propaganda Model of News for Our Digital Age. Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us today again on the Project Censored Show.
Mickey, it's been a real pleasure, and thanks for all the work that you and your team at Project Censored do.
It's an honor to work with you, Rob, and I would like to dedicate today's show, the Project Censored Show, to the late, great Edward Herman. I would also like to dedicate it to the late, great Robert Perry, Consortium News, who helped break the Iran-Contra case, who died not long ago, just a couple weeks ago. And last but not least, I want to dedicate it to a good friend of mine, a former student and intern, who passed away tragically 2 weeks ago. His name was Thomas Field. He worked with us on Censored 2018, a true news junkie and historian. He's in chapters 2 and 3 of the book and was working on a chapter with us for the next Censored book, and just a very untimely passing. And I would argue was really up and coming and in the running for one of the great, great media commentators. And so, again, Rob Williams, thanks so much for joining us today on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you, Mickey. We'll talk soon.
All right, take care.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. It's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, executive producer, along with Peter Phillips. And we founded the Project Censored Show back in 2010. Our producer is Anthony Fest. Our producer of today's program is Dennis Murphy from the studios of KPCA in Petaluma. Mitch Scorza also is a producer with the Project Censored Show down at California State East Bay, who works with Nicholas Baham III and Nolan Higdon as co-hosts, along with Amy Casey. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. Special thanks to Erica Bridgman, our engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York, and all of our shows are archived online at projectcensored.org. You can also like us and support us through our Patreon page. We'll see you next time. Citizens in the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.